The founding fathers of the U.S. Constitution pioneered a document that was to serve as the foundation to ensure the protection against mob rule and tyranny. This unique document only exists if it is applied as it's written, in order to prevent and to circumvent tyranny from posing as leadership. We're at such a time in history where personal liberty and life itself is being attacked, defiled, and voices censored. America has always been a unique country which has survived so many others without an observable dictatorship. If we allow this foundational blueprint to be usurped and manipulated, she will not only become an unrecognizable place of mass suffering, sickness, and slavery, but she will cease to exist as a free nation where life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is even possible for the many. It's up to all of us to show up for this divine appointment, an occasion that the U.S. Constitution is and was always meant to be. It's a marvel to behold. I'm Kim Greenhouse, and I want to welcome you all to this segment of It's Rainmaking Time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time, a show about ancient knowledge, new knowledge, discovery, breakthroughs, and the wonder and marvel of the human spirit. Before I introduce our remarkable guest, who is probably has the most robust and comprehensive understanding of the U.S. Constitution, I want to say to you that if you're somebody that values your freedom, the freedom to think, the freedom to express, the freedom to have your dominion, your say about your body and what happens to it, health freedom, to make your own determination what you're going to use for your health, you want to be listening to this. If you were ever to listen to anybody today about what's going on in the United States, what should be and shouldn't be going on relative to the Constitution and the abuse of power, it's Dr. Edwin Vera. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you.
I feel that I'm talking to a giant who was before his time and is now really should be received at this time. Most critically, this is really it for the United States of America. Well, do you agree?
Well, I think that's right. We're in a very serious situation, much more so than I've ever seen in those 47 years that I've been in the judicial process, at least. Because we have, how shall I put it, crises at every level of the system, from the electoral system to the COVID-19 problem that's now going on, to international relations with the Chinese and others. I mean, this is just a first-class mess in many, many ways. And one of the grave difficulties is that there are constitutional principles that are involved in everything we're talking about that most people don't understand.
That's why you're here, actually. But I'd like you to first distinguish out for those of us who are unfamiliar with a kind of resonant background rumbling, which is many are gathering together and saying that the Constitution is a living, breathing entity document that really should be able to be modified to, quote, modern times. And it sounds okay. It sounds like it's reasonable, but it has totally different meaning in terms of what was really laid out in the Constitution. Am I right or am I wrong?
Oh, well, you're right as to the latter part. It's totally unreasonable as a theory for a number of reasons. First, if you look at the Constitution itself, there is a specific provision for amendment. And if you had what they call today a living Constitution, which changes its effects, they don't change the words, but they change the meanings or the applications, depending on what the legislator may want to do, and particularly the judiciary may want to do, then you wouldn't need a specific provision for amendment. The amendments could be made essentially automatically in the course of social evolution, or however you want to define that process. Secondly, if you look back historically and ask yourself this, if someone laid a constitution in front of you and said, what this means now, it might not mean a week from now. It might not mean a month from now. It might not mean a year from now, because it's a living document and it depends on people's attitudes as time goes by. Would you sign on to any document of that nature?
No, because no. It's a morphing. Yeah,
you wouldn't know what you were doing, all right? So the principle is non-rational, number one. And number two, it really contradicts the structure of the Constitution itself. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't some living aspect to the Constitution. I'll give you the example. Article 1, Section 3, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution provides that Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states. Let's leave out the other parts of it. Well, what was commerce in the days when the Constitution was written? Well, it was business transactions that were being conducted in certain ways, and especially if you take transportation, what were they using? Sailboats, canals, ox carts.
Horses.
Horses, of course, all right? Well, those methodologies have changed. And so we can look at today and say, well, now we have railroads, we have automobiles, and so forth and so on. Those are methodologies of commerce. We haven't changed the Constitution by saying Congress can regulate those methodologies. Right? There's the difference. So you can have expansions in terms of what the Constitution applies to because technological and sociological conditions change. But we don't change the meaning of that basic word, commerce. Commerce still requires certain elements of traffic and transportation and purchasing and so forth and so on. And then the limitation on it, which is one of the limitations on it, among the several states, not within a particular state. So there's the distinction. So you can have a living constitution in that sense of the application of a particular term to new circumstances, but not in the sense of changing the meaning of that term.
Okay, I think that's where a lot of people get that's where people that are looking at this get confused, because if I didn't know what you just said, I would have said, oh, yeah, of course it's a living, breathing thing, right? It's alive. But really, that whole portal is meant to alter and make it malleable in a way that changes the fundamental structure.
That's exactly right. The living constitution theorists don't want to recognize that there are limitations beyond which they can't go unless they amend the Constitution. That's the secret of behind what they're trying to do. They're trying to evade the amendment process, primarily because, I think, if they put the amendment that they want before the people, it wouldn't pass.
Okay. So do you feel right now that the Constitution is being honored in this country, America?
Oh, no, absolutely not. In so many different ways, it's not.
Give us a few examples.
Well, let's take the example that we're facing right now of the COVID-19 lockdowns, for instance, and really what it seems the reluctance of the judiciary to step in on this. If you look at the basic constitutional limitation, and there are many more besides this, that no governmental body can deprive an individual of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's the general limitation. Well, what is liberty? Liberty is the ability to go about your normal affairs, do your business, go out, leave your home, whatever. If you're locked in your home pursuant to some ukase or dictate that's given by a public health official or governor or whatever it is, you have a liberty problem. Did he do that with due process of law? And who's supposed to determine that? Well, the courts are supposed to determine that. They're not supposed to simply roll over and say, well, some public health official came up with a determination. Because there are other public health officials, or at least other people practicing in that field, who come up with a different perspective on that problem. You can find plenty of information that says that these lockdowns have been far more detrimental for other reasons than they have been beneficial, because they kept people away from each other during the so-called pandemic situation. Well, why hasn't that been settled in a court of law the way we'd settle all other questions? Right, you might have experts that would have to testify about it, but we have experts testifying every day. Patent cases, automobile accident cases, medical malpractice cases. This is no different from the run-of-the-mill expertise, testimony, and use that's used in complex judicial cases. But the judiciary seems to have backed off from it and said,
When you say the judiciary, explain what you mean to the public. What does that mean? Does that mean the courts? Does that mean the judges? Are you speaking of the judges specifically?
Well, the governors or the mayors? It's a judiciary in the sense, number one, of the courts. Someone's coming to the courts. Well, who's coming to the courts? It could be public officials on the one hand. It could be private parties or private organizations on the other hand. You could have criminal cases. You could have civil cases, a whole series of things that could be done. And I look at some of these situations with, let's take those states in which the governors and the public health officials have said, send the COVID patients into the nursing homes.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. It's really not funny.
Well, it's not funny because how many people were killed by that process, all right? Now, immediately I look at that and I say, well, there are civil implications there from the people who die, their estates at least, their families. There are criminal implications as well. Was this done by these public health officials outside of their authority with knowledge or foreknowledge or failure to delve sufficiently into the facts?
How come we don't know? For example, how come we, the public, don't know whether the public health officials have the authority to do what they did, and we just blindly accept that they're doing it and that's the way it is? In other words, do they have the authority constitutionally? Any public health official across the United States, well, let's not even delve into other places in the world, but for right now, in the U.S., mm-hmm. with regard to the Constitution, in your expertise and experience, do the health officials have the constitutional authority to do what they're doing, to establish lockdowns, to find citizens, to keep them from going to work, to keep them from going to school, et cetera?
Oh, I would say the short answer to that is it's highly problematical that they do. All right.
Is that a yes or a no? I'm not clear.
Well, because you have different cases. So you have the case where what they're really attempting to do is to set up a quarantine of people who are sick. And that has generally been recognized as legitimate. If someone is sick, then action can be taken against that person that would tend to limit that person's liberty. Or perhaps they might be taking actions against the nursing homes, telling the nursing homes, you can't take people in who test positive, okay? So there are some things that they might be able to do. So the first thing you have to look at is, well, what is their statutory authority?
And please explain what a statute is, because most of us don't know.
Well, it's a law that's passed by whatever the legislature may be. So you could have a statute at the local level.
And when you say legislature, define that too, please.
Well, the legislature is that group of people who have been selected, usually by election, to enact laws.
So would we say a governor or a mayor is a part of the legislature?
No, those are executive officials. They don't have the power to make laws.
Okay. Right?
They may have the power to take certain actions pursuant to laws. They execute the laws. So a legislature might give a governor the ability to take action to quarantine nursing homes that have been tested for COVID-19, all right? So that would be the trail. But that legislative authority at the beginning has to have some constitutional basis. And that brings you into the general due process question. Life, liberty, or property, has this been done with due process of law in terms of the legislature's power? The legislature can't grant powers to the executive, and the executive can't take powers for itself or himself, as it were, that aren't justified within the Constitution. And certainly these administrative officials are at even a lower level because they are not elected. They're appointed by somebody, right? Usually it's the executive branch that determines that. So there's a kind of a double delegation of power. The legislature passes some statute. They give some authority to the executive. The executive turns over some of that authority to these administrators. And then the administrators, on the basis of their so-called expertise, come up with, we would hope, recommendations, but now they're coming up with dictates. They're saying this is what has to be done. And then the executive turns around and says, I'm going to use my police powers to enforce this, either through arrest, fines, whatever it might be. And the whole question is, in that chain of events, are there places where these various people have overstepped their constitutional limitations? And the answer is, on the face of it, in many instances, they certainly have.
Do you think that the public knew before this all happened, like everybody in their own states, that the governor and the mayors could literally shut the whole place down?
No.
If I knew that, how come we weren't taught this in school? I never knew this. My family didn't know this. Friends of mine didn't know this. I think millions of people are in shock that a governor and a mayor, and probably more, I don't know who else, but can just shut down a state, a county, shut down all the restaurants, shut down all the businesses, bankrupt the entire state. How can they do it?
Well, you see, you use the word can, and that's the question. It really may. Do they have the authority to do it? They've asserted this authority. And in our system, any assertion of authority by some public official is always, should always be subject to some kind of judicial challenge and test of the legality of that determination or dictate or whatever that the person come out with. Now, the problem with public education is exactly that. It's public education. The public educational system for reasons we might go into, has been loath to educate students about the real structure of our Constitution, especially the concept that the Constitution is a limitation on government. It's not only a grant of governmental authority, but it's a limitation on that authority, simply by a provision in the Constitution that spells out what the power of a legislature is in some respect. Power of Congress. You have the power to regulate commerce among the several states. That's also a definitional limitation. Your power goes among the several states, and it has to be commerce, not something else. And then we add to that a provision such as the Fifth Amendment applicable to Congress. Well, you can't exercise that power in a way that would deprive someone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So it's like a double limitation built in there. And the limitations are the most important part of the whole system, because otherwise you have, by hypothesis, what's called a totalitarian system. Government has total power.
That's what it feels like right now.
That's what they're
operating. That's what's happening.
That's the way they're operating.
So talk about, I want you to, for those of us who are unfamiliar, and I mean myself included, I want you to talk about what treason is. And I want to go back to the totalitarian part. I want you to describe not treason as it was defined by the English many, many years ago, but the constitutional translation of treason.
Well, I just happen to have brought along the thing that does that for you.
I don't even know how you read that. It's so small. I would need a magnifying glass.
This is the United States Constitution. Article 3. Okay. Article 3 deals primarily with the judiciary, but then they put in because they wanted to limit this to a judicial situation. Article 3, Section 3. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them. Stop right there. Bring troops into the field. Right? Create a conspiracy to arm men and overturn the government. Or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. So that depends upon who your enemies are, how you define that, and what is giving them aid and comfort. But the important part here is, besides that definition, which is, of course, a limitation now, if you look at the English law of treason at the time that the Constitution was written, it was very broad. It was kind of political crime. It was something the king could charge his enemies with and as a result maintain political control. So the Constitution is very careful to limit the definition of treason, to get away from its use or misuse in that way. And then it says, no person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. Now we bring the judiciary into this. Right? Congress can pass statutes because the next section says Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason. But what happens? Congress passes those statutes, and then when those statutes are applied by whom? The executive branch, the prosecutors, right? Get an indictment for treason. It goes into the courts, and in the courts, according to the Constitution, there have to be two witnesses to the same overt act, or the defendant has to confess in court. So we have a whole series of limitations built in. First, there's the definition, then the power of Congress to declare the punishment of treason, but not something else, and then the way the procedure works to have treason adjudicated.
So I want to go back to the part about treason, in that I'm not saying the public, I think I've mistranslated it. I always assumed when someone says, so-and-so is treasonous, that they're doing something against their country. And I always associated that with a military person. I never thought of it as a civilian person, except for a spy. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like somebody who's doing something that's really hurting their country for another country. Mm-hmm. That's the only two examples that I've ever understood. Give me another example or two.
Well, you've just touched on the second aspect of the definition, right? Adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Well, that's what espionage is all about, right? Spying on behalf of some foreign country that's considered to be an enemy of the United States. And that could be someone in the military, could be someone in civilian life, in government or outside of government. Could be almost anyone that was engaged in that type of activity. If you talk about levying war against the United States, that's the process of actually trying to bring armed people into the field. So it could be a military operation. Think of a military coup, for instance, where one branch of the military comes out and attempts to overthrow the government. But it's not limited to that. I mean, theoretically, this definition could apply to anyone who performs those prohibited acts.
So now I'm going to cut right into the election space.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say a few things that I know for sure. One is, ever since 2001, when the electronic voting machines were installed as part of the process, or the body of the elections, they have never been able to be secured. Not a single vote has been able to be secured ever due to man-in-the-middle technology. All of the people who were involved in the creation of the electronic voting machines knew that, and the people in IT at the highest level know that. And so my question is, and what I've been screaming about for years to the people that I know, is how come 20 years later, even though they were installed in 2001, where everything changed, Homeland Security and all this electronic voting, the people that put them into the space knew that you couldn't secure a single vote and they were hackable. And yet, it's been used for elections in this country for 20 years. Why?
Someone wanted to take advantage of the ability of those machines to defraud the electorate. Why else would you put a machine into operation that could defraud the electorate when you knew that that was the capability of the machine?
How come you feel the public doesn't know this? And I learned it in 2014, late in my life.
Oh, well, because the watchdogs in public office didn't inform the public. In public office, I include the media as well. I mean, obviously, media people that could have gotten a handle on what was going on here.
So how come Homeland Security or the election version of that can go on the air and say this was the election integrity is there? You can't. How can you do it? How can you say with man-in-the-middle technology? Okay, Stephen Smoot-Amour, do you know who he is?
Yeah. He went
all over the country trying to tell the United States citizens, you cannot secure a single vote.
Right.
And after 10 years, he said, I've had enough. I had a conversation with him before I went to live in Europe. I wanted to interview him so bad because he knew. One thing I love about him, he said, I'm a Republican, but I'll tell you what. I do not want to win by theft. I want an honest election more than I want my Republican Party to win. And until more people are there, you're not going to get an honest election. You're not going to get integrity in the election. So it's like wag the dog. The media and these entity bodies within the government are telling you and me and the public that this is handled when it's not handled.
No.
Man-in-the-middle technology, ladies and gentlemen. Man-in-the-middle technology. You can't secure a single vote. And yet we're expected to believe this. And so my question to you is, if there's no chain of custody, there's obviously no chain of custody in the electronic voting machines. I don't care what you call them, Dominion, Schminion, whatever is their name. There's no chain of custody that's transparent. So now when you get to the ballots, how come the public didn't know? I had no idea. All of these chain links, all of these steps that go on. I mean, there's more people involved in a process to vote. And the more people you involve, the more you have an opening of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
There's no transparent chain of custody. Mm-hmm. Why do we accept that even with the ballots?
Well, I'm not sure why we accept it other than to say that there hasn't been in the past an exposure of this problem. Right? It's coming out now because of the massive nature of the vote fraud claims that are being made. But obviously, if this has been going on at a lesser scale in the past, and we know that before the machine showed up, there was ballot fraud of one kind or another, dead people voting, absentee ballots, whatever it was. I mean, election fraud is something that didn't happen just in 2020.
Right.
And to a large extent, I think many Americans have simply shrugged their shoulders and say, well, that's the way things go. You know, they stuff ballots in Tammany Hall or one of these historic events. Now, all of a sudden, it's become apparent that any election can be rigged, especially if you're talking at the president. If they can get away with it at the presidential level, what else can they do? And so people's eyes have suddenly been opened. Unfortunately, it may be a little late in the game. You see, this should have been looked at beforehand.
Of course.
When these machines first came out, somebody in the Department of Justice and the FBI that have units that deal specifically with election tampering, election fraud, they should have said to themselves, wait a minute, we have to do some behind-the-scenes investigation on this to make sure that we're not going to find ourselves in a situation 3, 4, 5 years from now where we're going to have a massive investigatory problem to deal with. We have to correct this if it needs correction initially. Well, they didn't do that. And then now what do you see happening? You have Department of Justice, Attorney General Barr coming out the other day and saying, well, you know, we don't really need to investigate this. We can't find any massive. Please. That's not what happens in a proper investigation. You don't come out at the beginning and say, well, we haven't found anything, so we're going to stop. And the question is, why weren't you looking at this for the past 4 years? Why weren't you looking at 8 years? Well, how many years you go back? And I think it's really because there are people in the system that want this capability. And so they don't want you to know that they have this capability.
I agree with you. And that's why 90% of the public doesn't know what man in the middle is, what it means. Mm-hmm. 90% of the public, maybe more, has no clue and had no clue. And probably the difficult part of this is that if my team wins, I don't care. If your team wins, you don't care. I mean, that's the kind of ethos mm-hmm. out there. It's like, if my guy wins, okay, so whatever happens, happens. And that's where we're at. We're at the anything goes society. As long as my team wins, we don't need to look at it. We do need to look at it. And the fact that the media is going on there telling everybody this is a integral election space is a farce. It's a slap in the face to the American people. And by the way, any other culture that's using this. I want you to describe for the audience what is plausible deniability, because this is the key to me as to why electronic voting machines are being used.
Well, plausible deniability is rather a broad term. They use it in order to enable some governmental body, especially something like the CIA, for instance, to be able to say, to present a line to the public that will cause the public to believe that this agency wasn't involved in some nefarious activity, right? They're trying to prevent people from realizing the extent to which some public officials have been engaged in some sort of illegal activity. So they create a legend, as they call it in the spy game, right? This story out there that's broadcast to the people, maybe through friendly agents that you have in the media, that puts the agency in the position where it can deny its involvement in a plausible fashion, right? We weren't involved in this because of A, B, and C. Now, of course, A, B, and C may not be true, and you, the public, are not capable of getting behind A, B, and C, but on the face of it, it seems plausible, right?
Just like the electronic voting machines, okay, to use them knowing that you have man-in-the-middle technology that has 24/7 capability as an intercept that can change whatever's going on is a form of plausible deniability. Because if I'm running a machine, I can always say, China did it, Russia did it, this one did it, that one did it.
I didn't know, right? I'm running the machine, but I had no way of knowing. I'm not an IT expert. So when I was told to put these cards in there to run the machine, I didn't know what was happening. I didn't realize that all those votes were going to be sent to Barcelona to be manipulated, or Frankfurt, or wherever they say these votes were sent. So you can have a whole chain of, you think of, when they talk about a conspiracy, people always say, well, in a huge conspiracy, someone would always talk. That's not true, because in a huge enough conspiracy, there are people in the middle that don't realize they're part of the conspiracy. All right? People operate on a need-to-know basis.
Yeah.
You're giving this little card, and your supervisor says, plug that into the machine. You don't know why. But that was a key element in the conspiracy to move those votes from one candidate to the other candidate. Maybe even your supervisor didn't know because it was somebody else who told him to do that.
You said a very important thing besides the whole thing that you just said. You said a need to know. Through compartmentalization, which is the key you're really talking about, the need to know, you can take a project, you only have your part of a greater whole. You don't even know what the next person's doing or what they're accountable to or what their instructions are or what their orders have been. Mm-hmm. And if you compartmentalize enough elements in the project, you have an opening for total malfeasance.
All right.
And you also have people that don't know what's going on. They only know their part. Now, I do feel at a feeling level that a lot of people who were involved, and I'm not saying it didn't happen in other elections, but we're talking about this one right mm-hmm. now. A lot of people had animus one way or the other. It's a highly, polarized scenario. A lot of people did have animus who were happened to be volunteers. There's also a lot of great, incredible, honorable people mm-hmm. that were doing what they were supposed to do and were doing a duty and making a contribution to the country. But this need to know is very important and how everything was compartmentalized. And I think that until you have a fully transparent process from beginning to end, given what's happened, you have no real election. You have a kangaroo election. No, and I don't care how you dress it.
That's exactly right. And it has to be set up in such a way that it can be audited afterwards. Not simply recounting the illegal ballots,
right.
but auditing which ballots are legal and which are illegal.
By the way, that's another point that keeps happening on television, which I don't watch. I watch excerpts of things online. Mm-hmm. But the re-auditing of something that didn't happen properly or where there was malfeasance is just the regurgitation of that.
Yeah, the recounting.
Yes.
See, an audit, you would go through and say, here's an absentee ballot, and we can check the signature with the signature of the registered voter. Oh, the signatures don't match. Or perhaps there's no signature. Or perhaps the address is wrong. I can find all sorts of reasons to audit this and say, this ballot is no good. Now, on the other hand, if all I do is count all the ballots that have come in, what happens? This fraudulent ballot, this illegal ballot, still is counted. We haven't performed an audit. So an audit is different from a recount.
So why is it that the media keeps 24/7 talking about so-and-so recounted and everything is fine? Do they think that the people of this country are stupid?
Oh,
what do they think?
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure.
Well, it was recounted. Probably years ago, someone said, well, we did a recount. Because if you don't know the interior of the process, where there's signatures, there's ballots, there's matchups, there's a way of bringing the integrity into form, who would know?
No.
Somebody like me would say, well, they recounted, but they didn't audit, yes?
I have a stack here of $1,000 bills.
Yes.
And I can count those and I say, well, there are 20 of them. That's a count. That's a recount. I can do that 100 times, 1,000 times, get the same result. An audit would be, let's check which ones of these are counterfeit and pull them out. All right, let's do another test, not simply the counting. Let's do some other test to verify that these things should be in the batch that's going to be counted. Now, the media simply thinks the average person can be deceived by wordplay. That when they hear about a recount, the average person thinks to himself without really having a basis for it, that all sorts of provisions, security provisions, if you will, are being put into play. It's not simply the mechanical, all right? Or maybe some people think that that's all that has to be done. It's simply the mechanical recounting of a stack of ballots. But the media is playing that game because the difference, I think, is obvious to anyone who knows audit versus...
The distinction.
Audit versus recount. And why would they be saying... Why would they be using the same terminological approach unless they were trying to deceive you?
Look, the public, and self included, doesn't know the distinction between electors, legislators, electors. This whole domain is very obscured. I hope I'm not imposing this on anybody listening, but I feel that many of us are in the total dark. Who's appointing what? What is this certification about? How do you certify something that's been recounted when you haven't done a signature match, when you haven't really done a proper audit? How can you verify anything?
Well, if we start off with, I think, a basic misunderstanding people have of the presidential election. By the U.S. Constitution, the presidential election is not required to be a plebiscite.
I don't know what that means.
A vote of everybody.
Okay.
Okay? The presidential election, the so-called electors who go to the Electoral College, they could be selected by the legislatures of the states.
And who are they?
Those are the people whom you and I elect to become representatives and senators, if you have a two-house.
So is a governor an
elector? No.
Okay, a senator?
No. The legislature is, if you have a two-house legislature, you have the representatives and then you have the senators, just like Congress. That's a legislature. The president is an executive, all right? So the Constitution of the United States provides that ultimately the legislatures of the states can determine who the electors are. So you've had all sorts of different procedures that have been used throughout American history. This idea of the plebiscite is probably the most recent one, because they had some in earlier times, and it's become the most popular one. So we use all of that. But if you look at the Constitution, if there were a legislature could come in now in one of these disputed states and say, we've looked at this election, and there are so many questions of potential fraud that we are not going to allow this plebiscite to determine the electors. We, the legislature, will step in, and we will determine who the electors are.
So what's happening now in the U.S.? Right now?
Well, what's happening now in some of the states, the Republicans, of course, Trump's people, are going to the legislatures, which are in those states Republican, and saying, you have to step in because these elections, the plebiscites, were so tainted by fraud or other questions that they're really not valid. We can't depend upon those as the means for selecting the electors. The legislators have to step in. And that would not be unconstitutional. I think it would be highly unpopular. You'd have a huge number of people screaming about that. So, but that's one thing people don't understand, that the electoral process for the president is a very special kind of process. And the reason for that was essentially twofold. Well, the states initially, before the Constitution, were independent political entities. Declaration of Independence calls them free and independent states. All right? And they had certain powers. They could make treaties, potentially. They had their own armies, potentially.
Each state?
Each state, okay, because they were independent states. Now, they form the Articles of Confederation, and they limit themselves to a certain extent there, and then they create the Constitution of the United States and limit themselves even more. And in two places, the states limited themselves. First, they can't make treaties, period. No state can make treaties with a foreign country. And no state can have its own army without the consent of Congress. All right, so they're limited. Well, who ends up making treaties under the Constitution of the United States? It's the President of the United States. So he's taken over that very important power from the states. Who is the Commander-in-Chief of the Army? It's the President of the United States. So he's taken over that power. And even the militia of the states, which is separate from the Army, if the militia is called up by Congress, the President becomes Commander-in-Chief. So you can see why the states, when the Constitution was written, why they were very concerned about having a special role in electing the President, because he was going to exercise these powers that they, the states, previously had and were very important powers of sovereignty. They were giving up sovereign powers under this system. So that's why this peculiar electoral process is built into the Constitution. And there's a famous case, McPherson versus Blackmer, I think it was 1892, that goes into the complete history of all this Supreme Court decision, lays it all out and says, you know, they were doing this, and then they went to this, and they changed this, and back and forth. You've had all these different procedures for electing the president. But when it comes right down to it, the ultimate power is in the legislatures of the states. So we're beginning to see that now. And, of course, that's some of these lawsuits that are going on, the one in Texas versus the other states and so forth. This all is percolating to the surface. What's interesting, though, is it's percolating to the surface for the first time in many, many years or decades of American history. The average American is looking at this saying, what's going on? I've never heard of any of this before.
I never even heard that the Secretary of State in each state is the one to certify an election. Is that true?
Well, it depends
Who's
upon...
Who's certifying?
Well, it depends upon what the legislature says. But even that certification, here you run into a problem. What good is a certification if it's predicated on fraud? All right? Fraud vitiates anything along that line. And a legislature could certainly come in and say, oh, well, we have a certification from this executive official. But we have the ultimate power, the legislators have the ultimate power to determine who the electors are, and we're simply going to throw that out.
I want to talk to you about the Equal Protection Clause, which mm-hmm. is being kind of circulated heavily in the election space. And I don't understand it, and when I hear it, all I think about are people should be able to see and witness the votes. But I think it has to do with something bigger than that, does it?
Well, if we're talking about an election situation, we're talking about the laws of the particular state applying equally to everyone who's entitled to vote. And it comes up in Article 14, the 14th Amendment. It says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Well, stop right there. Voting in a federal election is a privilege or immunity of a citizen of the United States. So no state can enforce any law, make or enforce any law of its own that will abridge that federal right. Then it goes on to say, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, which we talked about. That's the general limitation. And then we come to the Equal Protection Clause. Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So if I have an electoral system in state X that allows everyone to vote and then counts everyone's vote for whoever the officers are, representative, senator, governor, then I have to provide equal protection, equal benefit, if you will, of that law to everyone. I can't engage in suppressing someone's vote by tearing up their ballot, keeping them from the polling place, putting a false ballot in, diluting their vote by putting in false ballots. There's a whole series of things that would fall under electoral fraud that would come potentially under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, provided that it's some state official that's doing it, because it says no state shall do that. If we're talking about some private individual that's stuffing ballots secretly, then you have another question, and it's a criminal law problem that deals with that. So if you look at the situations that are going now and you say, all right, these states were engaged, some of the states were engaged in procedures which the state officials knew, or they were recklessly indifferent to the fact that these procedures could deny certain segment of the electorate the full value of those people's votes, then you have an equal protection problem.
So right now, the word on the media or in the media is that POTUS is not accepting defeat. Everything is okay. The integrity of the election has been maintained. All is well. And he's lost X number of civil cases. And gesund, that's it. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Where are you at about that?
The only thing that's right in that sequence is the first thing, that he's not accepting the result of this election.
Okay.
All right. All the rest of it is argumentative. And I would say, you know, if they're not looking at the evidence, you have a lot to look at. Evidence is not something that's determined when a complaint is filed in a court.
Okay.
You make allegations. You say, I think I can prove this. The proof then comes up later, typically speaking. It might come up through affidavits being provided, a procedure called summary judgment. Typically, in the long run, it comes up through a trial where witnesses testify before a jury. Right? None of that has happened. So far, all of these cases, as far as I can tell, complaints have been filed, which is the very first step. Sometimes they've attached to these complaints affidavits from potential witnesses to bolster the allegations that are made in the complaint, although that may not be necessary unless you're talking about actual fraud. And then the judges, on some theory of their own, have said, well, you know, there's really no evidence. I'm just going to throw this out.
Can they do that?
Can they? Yeah, they can do essentially anything they want.
Is that constitutionally acceptable?
No.
Why?
Well, because the procedures that we have in the judicial system, you make a charge in a complaint. You say, these are the alleged facts. I think this, 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 and this happened. And if all these things are true, then there are certain legal consequences, which is I win and you lose. And then there will be some, you'll pay a fine, or you'll pay me damages, or the injunction, whatever, some remedy, right? So at that first step in the case, typically speaking, all the judges look at is the allegations and say, well, if these were true, right, and we're saying speculation, if these were true, would there be a legal claim that the courts could enforce? That's what they're supposed to do at that stage. They are not at that stage to determine whether these allegations are true or not. It's only if they are true. Now, some allegations might be so incredulous that a judge would say, well, I'm not going to accept this at all. Right? An allegation, the moon is made of green cheese, therefore I win the case, right? The allegation is no good.
How can they be thrown out is my question.
Well, they can't be thrown out. What I'm trying to explain to you is the procedures don't allow them to be thrown. They have to go to the next step.
But it's reported that they are throwing them out.
Well, the judges are making it up as they go. They don't want to create some kind of real constitutional crisis. We've seen this before. There was a story, I don't know how true it is, but this is a story that was reported. In the Kennedy-Nixon election in 1960, there were claims that there was massive electoral fraud in Illinois and there was electoral fraud in Texas. And supposedly some of Nixon's advisors said, you need to challenge this. It's close enough so that you might be able to win if we challenge it. And Nixon said, kind of patriotic attitude he had, said, no, I don't want to do that because that would cause a constitutional crisis. People to lose confidence in our system.
And do you think he believed that, or do you think he was ordered to speak?
Well,
that?
I don't know, but that's the story.
Okay.
All right, just leave it at that. That's
all
the
right.
story. And I would have said to him, Mr. Nixon, the constitutional crisis is letting someone be elected president on the basis of fraudulent votes. That's the constitutional crisis, because we'll see that done again and again and again. If you don't stop it the first time that we have sufficient evidence, then it will be a quote-unquote precedent that others will use, all right? And so now we have this situation, and I'm fairly sure that at least some of these people in the judiciary are looking at this and saying, oh, if we open up this Pandora's box, if we open up this can of worms, there will be all sorts of political consequences which we can't control, we can't even predict. And therefore, we're going to put the lid on it, all right? Oh, yes, well, they'll be burning the cities down, right? And we can't control that. See, this is the whole point. We the judges, we can give a determination that the state of X conducted a fraudulent election and therefore certain consequences with respect to electors. But what then happens politically? What then happens socially? We can't control that. So better for us to sit back and just leave the lid on.
So, like in finance and banking, it's like kicking the can down the road in the economy.
That's the reason that they never challenged the Federal Reserve System, if I can make an aside. Because they could come in, the judges could come in at the level of the Supreme Court, let's say, and say, oh, this provision of the Federal Reserve Act is unconstitutional. But now what? They can't tell Congress how to correct it. They can't tell how the markets how to respond to that decision. They can't tell international finance what to do when the Federal Reserve note is a world reserve currency, but the Supreme Court of the United States is saying part of the Federal Reserve Act is unconstitutional. So the judges will say, my goodness, we can create havoc if we decide this case. Therefore, we're not going to decide the case. We're going to evade it in some way.
Hold your horses. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Edwin Viera, with its rainmaking time. Thanks so much.